uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, live365.org, live365's American FM, and whiterosesociety.org, also podcast on White Rose Society, and in 29 states and cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Congressman Dennis Kucinich is with us in the studios this morning. Hey, good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Tom. As you're giving your intro, I'm thinking of the intro to the early series of Superman fighting a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
There you go. Well, is it research or plagiarism? I wonder. Unconscious.
It's good to be on your show, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. If you have a question for Congressman Kucinich or you'd like to speak with him, he'll be with us for the first 30 minutes of our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Also, if you'd like to drop into the chat room, live chat room already well populated with folks from all over the, literally all over the world on several continents, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat, and that'll drop you in there. Dennis, the Supreme Court this morning ruled that the 10 states that have passed medical marijuana laws, now if you are living in one of those states, registered in one of those states as a medical marijuana user, as the law required, you went to a doctor, you got a prescription, you did the right thing, you are now on a list that the DEA can use to kick in your door and drag you off. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm hopeful that's not going to happen, but I'm also hopeful that Congress will take action to make it legal for people to use medical marijuana.
Yeah. You were the only presidential candidate to raise this topic.
Well, compassion requires us to realize that people who are terminally ill or have an illness that is not going to they'll easily recover from, we need to make sure they have any kind of help from pain that they can receive. And it's just mind-boggling that a Supreme Court, which prides itself on so-called conservative values, ought to reject 10 states who have passed medical marijuana laws.
Dennis, the Democratic Party has, I don't know how to say it, come under, shall we say, some criticism. I had last week, when I was broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., during the Take Back America conference, a spokesperson for the Democratic Party on the program, and I asked a question about Ohio and the Conyers Commission report and voting machines and all this kind of stuff. And this fellow made the comment like, well, that's in the past. We need to leave the past behind us. We need to be looking forward to the future. And I'm like, well, what about these voting machines that are going to be in the future? Oh, I said, don't you think that, the privatization of our vote is the most horrific of all privatizations? I mean, it's even more horrible than privatizing. In Britain, they're still, upset that they privatized the railroads. I mean, we have privatized. And he says, well, whether you want to privatize or socialize, I don't think we should be having that debate. And my listeners just went nuts. The Democratic Party just in some ways seems in so much disarray. And yet at the same time, I'm telling people all the time, we live in a country that is a two-party system. And until we get IRV or change to a parliamentary proportional representation system, we don't have any other choices. You've been in the Democratic Party all your life. You're a participant in the Democratic Party. You're sticking with the Democratic Party. What do you have to say, number one, to our listeners who are concerned about the direction the party is going, and number two, to your own party about what they should be doing about these things?
Well, first of all, I agree with your listeners who are concerned about the Democratic Party. I am. That's why I ran for president, to say the Democratic Party ought to stand for universal, single-payer, not-for-profit health care. The Democratic Party ought to stand for the repeal of NAFTA and GATT, and to get out of the WTO and establish fair trade based on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles. The Democratic Party ought to stand for peace. We should have been leading the way opposed to the war in Iraq, and we should be leading the way in getting out of Iraq. The Democratic Party ought to stand for a full employment economy with public works and rebuilding America's infrastructure. I mean, if we stand for something, we'll give the people viable alternatives, which will cause people to want to vote Democrat.
Yeah, ideally, hopefully. We have a number of callers here. I'm Scott, our call screener, is in the same room with you. And Scott, you can just talk to people on the phone quietly, because Dennis's mic is real, real directional, and so as long as you're speaking softly, it won't pick it up, so don't worry about that. Dennis, you were in town here in Portland yesterday. You and I both spoke. You were the keynote speaker at an event at the Unitarian Church, talking about the Department of Peace and about peace in the world. Why a Department of Peace instead of a Department of Defense, or in addition to a Department of Defense?
Well, the Department of Peace is about tapping our capacity to make peace in our society. And to do that, we look at the domestic challenges we have. The Department of Peace would address domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse, violence in the schools, police-community relations problems, racial violence, violence against gays, all those symptoms in our society which demonstrate that maybe we don't have a grip on things, but which, through our everyday work, through education, through working with non-governmental organizations, we can give people the skills they need to be able to develop away from the plague of violence that assaults ourselves, our homes, our families, our communities.
And this would be a cabinet-level position, so that every time the president sits with his cabinet and a decision is made, there's going to be somebody in that room saying, and what's its impact going to be on peace?
Well, someone in the room who has skills for peacemaking.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing about a Department of Peace is to create a culture of peace. Right now, we have anything but that. Right now, there are leaders in our country who believe in the inevitability of war. What if we develop a consciousness of the inevitability of peace? That peace is inevitable because we've developed the skills, because we've taught our children peacemaking, peace building, peace sharing, peace giving, looking at the other person as an aspect of oneself. I mean, the whole world is interconnected and interdependent. It's time that we develop those skills in our own society that connect us to the aspirations of people all over the world for a more peaceful world. And we can do it by beginning here at home.
Yeah, well said. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jay in Atlanta is on the line. Hey, Jay, you're live with Congressman Dennis Kucinich.
Hey, Mr. Kucinich, it's an honor to speak with you. I think the world of you, I'm sure you would have been the most outstanding prime. Be that as it may, I think you're ahead of your prime, because we all know that this country is not ready for a man like yourself, unfortunately. So I have a question and a suggestion. Who would you have liked to have been the nominee if it hadn't been you, obviously? And I'm sure you wouldn't have Kerry as your first choice. Who was your first choice?
Well, let me tell you, once John Kerry won the nomination, I supported him. And he was the candidate. So, you know, I got along with all the individuals who ran. There are a lot of fine men and fine women in Carol Moseley Brown who ran for president. There are many people who are capable of leading this country. But I think that we as Democrats have to expect more of ourselves, that we have to give people real options. If people need more than just saying, well, they're going to vote for a party label, they want to see what someone stands for, and they want some depth. And I hope that what we are doing on this station this morning is using this opportunity to have a deeper discussion about who we are, about what we can accomplish for the nation. We have to be more than just Democrats and Republicans. We have to express our capacity to be citizens of America, citizens of the world.
Well said. Jay in Orlando's on the line with a question for Congressman Kucinich. Hey, Jay.
Hey, this is Patrick in Orlando, Florida.
Oh, I'm sorry, Patrick. Hey, Patrick.
That's all right. Hey, Dennis Kucinich, are you going to be running for president in the next election?
Well, I don't know. I'm making the rounds. I mean, I'm traveling the country to talk about these issues.
I really hope you do. Out of all the candidates there, I thought you were the most grounded, the well-spoken, and had the most direction for this country, the best direction, the peace, the medical marijuana. You've got it all together, and I cannot believe it. You know, granted, Kerry won a nomination, but you should have won it.
Let me just say this.
Please run again for president. I will vote for you.
Thanks for saying that. And people who need more information about the issues I'm working on can go to my website at kucinich.us. But let me tell you, you say I'm grounded. I appreciate that observation. My experience in politics comes from local government. I was a councilman in the city of Cleveland, served 4 terms in the Cleveland City Council. And, Tom, every day in Cleveland, what I had to do is make sure the chuck holes or potholes were filled, that the streetlights were on, that the catch basins were clean, that the police and fire responded quickly, that the recreation facilities were working. Those are the kind of practical things that I worked on day in and day out. Same thing I had to do when I was mayor. And that practical experience has a way of causing me to relate to the practical aspirations of people for jobs, for health care, for retirement security, for a clean environment, for all those, and for peace.
Yeah, and it's such, that's the important breeding ground sounds a little more like mosquitoes, incubator or whatever. We need to be encouraging. I was at a Democracy for America meetup in Burlington, Vermont last year, and nobody was expecting it, but both Howard Dean and Bernie Sanders showed up. And the discussion became, who's going to run for dog catcher? Who's going to run for city council? Who's going to run for the library board? I mean, because the big jobs, you know, and this is where it starts. And you're a living example of that, well, running for president.
Absolutely. Everyone who is listening right now, who has an interest in local government, get involved. I mean, local government is that unit of government which is closest to the people. It's a unit of government where you can have some direct impact on what's happening, where you bring people together. You can knock on doors and talk to people about what's happening in the community and develop those skills that are helpful as you move up. I mean, I served in city council, clerk of courts, which is a quasi-judicial position, elected office in Cleveland, mayor of Cleveland, state senator, member of Congress, and presidential candidate. I mean, it's one step at a time. That way you learn the skills that are needed in order to navigate not just government, but to be able to be in touch with the aspirations of the people at all levels.
Yeah, so important. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Tomas in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tomas.
Hey, Mr. Kucinich, I want you to expound a little bit. I'm a conservative, and I want you to expound a little bit on this peace, Department of Peace. For example, how would your Department of Peace responded to a terrorist attack of the 9/11 sort? Because, you know, it sounds like you're talking about surrender, and I want to give you a chance to, you know, change my mind.
Well, first of all, we have an obligation to defend our country. To provide for the common defense is one of the foundational principles of the United States. However, we must know the difference between defense and offense. I mean, I was a third-string quarterback on a high school team that had only two strings, okay? And I knew the difference between defense and offense. Our country went on the offense against Iraq. What we could have done after 9/11 is to find a way to reconcile with the world community and not to attack a nation that didn't attack us. That only made it worse. That actually increased the danger of a terrorist attack on this country. It didn't make us safer. So the Department of Peace, on an international level, would look at those areas where violence could percolate. We wouldn't be giving arms to nations. We wouldn't be selling biological and chemical weapons to nations, as we did to Iraq. We wouldn't be causing a proliferation of nuclear materials, as we've done over the years with other countries. What we would do is we'd look where there's famine, where there's poverty, where there's drought, where there's any kind of motion going on where people are suffering, and get peacemakers in there. People who are trained at a peace academy, just like people who are trained at West Point and Annapolis, can go in and help project the military power of America. We'd have people projecting the peaceful capacity of our nation.
While still preserving intact our full ability to defend ourselves.
We'll always defend ourselves, yeah. But peace is another way to defend ourselves.
There you go. We're talking with Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We're talking with the Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who is live and in the studio with us today. And very, 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 very pleased to have Congressman Kucinich with us. And we've got the phone lines are slammed here, Dennis. Let's just take some phone calls and see what's up and what's on people's minds. And then eventually we'll get back around to some of the questions I have for you.
Go for it.
Okay. All righty. Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Good morning, gentlemen. It's an honor to talk to you, Congressman. Tom, I said this morning a great song would be It's a Long Walk to D.C. by the Staple Singers.
There you go.
Anyway, I got chills on right now, honestly, on my body, thinking about this. What John Kennedy said in May of 1961, now it is the time to take longer strides, time for a great new American enterprise, time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement. which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth. I think we have two clear goals now that would be a great achievement: stem cell research and curing diseases, and the push for alternative energies. I think we could put a whole lot of initiatives behind those two overarching goals. I think that the program
Scott, can you boil this down to a question
what kind of great overarching goal do you see for this country that we can put many more goals behind?
Good one, Scott. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that, and Scott alluding to the positive energy that President Kennedy brought in, showing that America could use its ingenuity and its heart to project the dreams of people to go to the moon, we can summon the same kind of power in our country to develop alternative energy, and we need to.
Yeah. We already have the technology.
Well, we do. I mean, and the question is to invest in wind and solar and geothermal and biomass and green hydrogen and all those burgeoning energy technologies that will enable us to get away from the use of fossil fuel. We already know we're looking at peak oil in a couple of years. We know that we're looking at a diminishing capacity to be able to supply oil to the world. And we also realize that oil is a basis for international conflict. We need to move to energy which is peaceful, which is sustainable, and which is lower cost. And as we do that, we'll cause greater prosperity in our society. We'll have a more peaceful society, and we'll have a society where we'll protect the physical planet, which is being degraded by the use of fossil fuel, which is creating global climate change and causing havoc with our environmental systems.
So, pretty straightforward. This seems like a no-brainer, yet the Bush administration is so opposed to it. They just want to give welfare to the oil industry.
Well, this is a chance for all Americans, whatever their party, to realize that we have the capacity to be more than we are and better than we are. And the whole idea of transferring to alternative energies is to help with the survival of ourselves and our planet and to enable us to achieve our far-flung dreams of who we can be as a nation and what we can become as a world. So it's time for us to go past this dark journey into selfishness, which our addiction to oil represents.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. Now, you mentioned, we have just about a minute before we have to take another quick break, but you mentioned to me during the last break that you are already participating in a bill with Barney Frank to decriminalize medical marijuana.
Well, it's important for Congress to take action, particularly in the wake of this Supreme Court decision today, which wipes out the hopes of people in 10 states to be able to get relief from pain. It's just incomprehensible that the Supreme Court would try to knock down the state's abilities to be able to provide relief for terminally ill patients.
Yeah. And so legislation is there's already legislation in place?
Barney Frank has legislation. Representative Maurice Hinchey, together with Dana Rohrabacher, a conservative Republican from California, put a bill on and an amendment on the Commerce Justice. I think we need to go back to Congress, and whatever is necessary to move a bill through, we ought to do that. I mean, this is a matter of compassion as well as a matter of states' rights.
As well as a matter of life and death for many of these folks.
It is.
It very much is. Congressman Dennis Kucinich with us in the studio, taking your calls. Frank in Phoenix, Alice in Eureka, Mike in Canton, Will in Orange County, California. You're up next. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Sick and tired of feeling famous from outside, short-sighted, narrow-minded, hypocritic.
And speaking of the truth, one of the nation's great truth tellers, Dennis Kucinich, in the studio with us. Welcome back, Congressman Kucinich.
Good to be here.
It is so good to have you here, and great to have you here in Portland. A marvelous talk you gave yesterday at the Unitarian Church. Our telephone number, if you have a question or comment for Dennis Kucinich, 1-866, toll free across the United States, 866-889-8894. If you're calling from outside the United States, 503-248-8894. 0620. And let's go right back to the phones. Frank in Phoenix is on the line. Hey, Frank, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Hey. You're live with Congressman Kucinich.
How's it going, Congressman?
Okay, good morning.
You are a true Democrat, unlike my Congressman, Ed Pastore, who voted yes on that bankruptcy bill. He disappointed me. Anyway, you remember Carter 20 years ago? Didn't he have a 20-year plan on energy? And one last thing. As far as voting laws, why are these people only getting a few months in jail? How come these laws aren't harsher? Where, you know, I mean, this is a matter of trust. Shouldn't they be getting 20 years in jail or 40 years in jail for what they've been doing as far as their, you know, what they've done to the Democrats with blocking their phones and so on and so forth? Well, I think this is a tragedy.
Well, you know, did you say voting laws? Is that what he said?
Yeah, I think he's talking about, for example, in New Hampshire, there were a couple of Republicans who were just convicted during the primaries. Or no, during the general election in 2000. They were slamming the phone lines Democratic Democratic get-out-the-vote people so that they couldn't call up people. And they got, like, you know, 3 months in jail or suspended sentence or something.
Exactly.
At the same time, people who smoke pot are 20 years in jail, you know.
Well, voting laws are appropriate in this regard. People shouldn't be permitted to play dirty tricks in a political process. And, of course, as I travel the country, people are very concerned about the fact that their votes may not even count because electronic voting can be tampered with. That's one of the reasons I'm introducing a bill to provide for paper balloting in all presidential elections so people will have a paper receipt on election day, which would be a holiday, so people could vote for 24 hours, and the paper receipts would be the way that people would at least have a way of assuring that there's some ability to check.
And not just a receipt, but also there's a paper ballot.
Paper ballot.
Right.
That's
what
it'd be about.
Very,
paper
very
ballot.
Important stuff.
Thanks, Tom.
Good on you. Matthew in Canton, Ohio on the line. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, referring to the caller, a few callers ago, he was talking about energy, and you mentioned pollution and all that stuff. Did you hear that pollution has been down? It's the lowest it's been in 30 years. Have you heard that sentence?
By whose measurement?
By whose measurement? John Stossel from 2020 ABC, you know, one of
the... John Stossel, the notorious libertarian conservative.
Wait, I have to tell you something seen.
He was also in the liberal media. He can go to 2020 on ABC.
John Stossel will come right out and tell you. John Stossel will come right out and tell you, Matthew, that he's a conservative. That he's a libertarian, rather.
That means he's wrong just because he's a conservative?
Well, wait, let me
so
just...
Is that why you just bat him down?
Wait, I don't know about all that, but let me just talk to you about what I know about global climate change. I'm glad to listen to your caller, but if he wants a response, I'd be glad to respond, whatever he wants.
Yeah, I'll pot Matthew down and you can talk, and then I'll pot him back up if he wants to say something.
Yeah, I'd be glad to talk to Matthew, but here's the thing. There is such a thing as global climate change. Now, I know there are people saying it's not happening. Our global climate is being degraded. Our reliance on fossil fuels has created conditions where we're seeing the ozone layer being eroded. We're seeing the polar caps melting. I just came from Alaska, where they're starting up north to see some of the effects on the global climate, adverse effects. People are having to shield their skin near the Arctic Circle from increased ultraviolet rays. The migration patterns of caribou are changing. You're starting to see real adverse impact, sea levels rising. Look at all the changes in meteorologic phenomena that we've all experienced in our own lifetimes. The changes in weather patterns have been quite severe in places, and that's been traced by meteorologists to changes in the global climate due to our energy policies.
Due to carbon dioxide pollution.
Right. So we can't get away from that, and no amount of talk show equivocation can change some scientific facts that if we don't do something to start to limit carbon emissions, we are going to cause our children to live in a world that's going to be racked by incredible storms, that's going to have a decreased capacity to grow food, that's going to see sea levels rising. I mean, this is a serious matter. It ought to be taken seriously. For anybody to say, well, there's less pollution today, They must be breathing different kind of air.
Well, I think the point that Matthew was making, and there's some reality to this, is that back in I forget which year it was, 72 sticks in my head, that a Democratic Congress passed the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Richard Nixon signed it into law, and a government agency came in and said to industry, "You cannot pollute anymore. There are going to be limits on this." And in your own state, you had a river that caught on fire. Was it the Cuyahoga? Was it?
Right.
Yeah. And that, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of environmental cleanup since then. The point, though, I think that is missed so much by the cons on that side is that Bush, with his Clean Skies Initiative, would roll these things back. It hasn't started to be really obvious and visible yet, but there's a huge effort to roll these back. Is that, Matthew, is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about, yes, John Stossel reported, and you can go back, he quoted many scientists, very reputable, and said that pollution has been down in the past 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, great. And as a result of the Democratic legislature, the House of Representatives, passing the law creating the EPA, and now Bush wants to reverse that. His Clear Skies Initiative would reverse, even Clinton's, for example, he wants to increase the amount of mercury in the air. Thoughts, Dennis?
Well, certain types of pollution might be down, but the fact of the matter is that our environment continues to be threatened by contamination of water. Our environment continues to be threatened by nuclear power plants, which are unstable. Our environment continues to be threatened by policies which would, as you said, roll back environmental quality. The environment's threatened by policies which would drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. We need to have energy policies which are sustainable and supportive of environmental integrity. And we can have that. And that's what the great debate is about in this country today. Can we remain an economically progressive nation and at the same time be able to protect the environment? What's happened, Tom, is that there's been a type of thinking which has decoupled environmental quality from economic progress. I say they're one and the same. Right. I say the industries of the future will be industries that make enormous amounts of money by having sustainable energy policies in wind and solar and geothermal and green hydrogen and so many other areas.
And not producing pollution.
1-866-889-8894,
our telephone number, Will in Orange County, California on the line. Hey, Will.
Hey, good morning. How you doing? Hello?
You're live. What's your question?
Oh, okay. Hold on. Thank you very much. I was just wondering what exactly, if anything, is being done about the delay supporting the work in the Marianas and slave labor, and the party, I guess, is getting a lot of support, the Republican Party, from that.
Well, I can just tell you that the Central American Free Trade Agreement is up, and that we need to vote it down because that agreement and NAFTA and GATT never intended to protect workers' rights or provide for human rights. Workers do not have, in these trade agreements, rights to organize, rights to collective bargaining, right to strike, right to decent wages and benefits, right to a safe workplace, right to be compensated if they're injured on a job, right to a secure retirement. Workers are denied that, and the trade agreements were written specifically to preclude workers' rights. Trade agreements were written to preclude human rights. So we have work that is or products that are produced by slave labor, prison labor, child labor. Trade agreements were written to preclude environmental quality protections. And I say that we need to repeal NAFTA and GATT, get out of the WTO, and rebuild a trade structure which is based on fair trade and which has moral principles, Tom, involved of workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles.
Well said. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Bill in Cleveland, Ohio, listening presumably on Radio Free Ohio there?
No, I'm listening on the stream, Tom.
Okay. Hey, Bill, what's your question?
Well, I just got back from the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections meeting, and, so I'm kind of a little upset and all that kind of thing. But I want to ask Dennis, who is in a neighboring precinct. I'm in Stephanie Tubbs Jones' area, and I wanted to ask him what his feeling is on getting any true election reform going through either the Congress or the Senate, or hopefully all the way through.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Again, as we've seen from the calls that come into the station, the American people are very concerned about the integrity of the election process. And electoral reform begins with having confidence that our vote is going to count. And as I mentioned earlier, I believe we should go back to paper ballots in presidential elections, which is the ultimate receipt. I think that election reform would involve giving people a 24-hour period in which to vote and make Election Day a holiday or tie it into an existing holiday. We need to start with that. But we need to also give people a reason to vote. I mean, there's one thing to say, to go out and tell people to vote and to assure that they'll have their right to vote protected. It's another thing for political parties to give people real alternatives so people can make a choice and feel excited about going to vote. We're having trouble encouraging people to vote because, frankly, people don't feel that there's something in it for them. And one way we could do it, Tom, I think, if just one issue alone, health care, if we told the American people that if they went out and voted for change and they would get a universal, single-payer, not-for-profit health care system which would cover everyone in this country, I think that would be a way that you can increase the turnout immeasurably. That, together with voting reforms that would protect the integrity of the ballot box, could see a renewal of our democracy.
Yeah, I agree. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alice in Eureka, California. Hey, Alice.
I just wanted to let you know, Congressman, that all over Humboldt County, we still have your bumper stickers on our cars. The world would be in far better shape if it were you in the White House.
Well, I think there are a lot of good, thank you. There are a lot of good people out there who are in public life, and they need to be encouraged, and I appreciate your encouragement. But I will say that people in Humboldt County, thank you for your support. But we need to work together. And when I was visiting Humboldt County, I saw people who were really keyed into alternative energy,
mm-hmm.
and who are also looking, by the way, at promoting organic agriculture,
right.
and at and trying to preserve both sustainable to move towards sustainable energy practices, but also towards sustainable agriculture. People in Humboldt County, California, are really attuned to that, and people all over the country are attuned to it. So what I've tried to do, Tom, is to reach out to people and show that all these new ideas which we have the capacity to become of a new part of a new America.
Great. And Alice, thanks for listening on KGOE there in Eureka. 1-866-889-8894. John in Akron, Ohio on the line. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Great. What's up?
Good. It's a pleasure to talk to both you, Tom, and Congressman Kucinich. Have to admit that I've been in, I don't know if it's a depression or some kind of funk since November, and I'm just getting a little bit of positive feedback now, so I appreciate it.
Okay.
Question for Congressman. It appears to me, and there's a number of columnists that are writing about this, that the expertise of the Republican strategists, such as Karl Rove, seem to be able to marginalize different segments of our society. I'm concerned that is going to continue to succeed, and I'm wondering if you feel that the Democratic Party has someone with a different and more positive strategy.
Good question, John. Thank you.
Well, there's so much about political strategy that ignores something essential about us, and that is, you know, we all have hearts, and we have to have a politics which opens up its heart. The Supreme Court ruling is heartless that opposes the use of medical marijuana. Healthcare policies which keep 46 million people without health insurance, that's heartless. Policies which cause people to not have adequate housing, heartless. Politics which take away people's jobs and their pensions, heartless. I mean, we need a politics with a heart, and when political strategies are just about trying to win and not helping the people win, they really cause an erosion of support for the democratic process. Our politics have to have a heart, and if you listen closely, people will tell you their heart, and people want to come together. It's not about Democrat and Republican anymore. It's about who we are as Americans. It's about a deeper conversation which touches people's hearts and which shows that government can appeal to people's practical aspirations for jobs, for health care, for retirement security, for a cleaner environment, and for peace.
Well said. We have about a minute left. Maybe a quick question here. Joe in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
What would you say to the young people nowadays who seem to be enamored by Prince George in Washington, who he seems to be a war hero, the president? They seem not to be as fighting back.
They're not seen beyond the commander-in-chief persona.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's like he's Top Gun.
Yeah, okay, Dennis.
Well, what I'd say to young people is we need your talents and abilities to build a better nation. And we can do that if we give young people a chance to have good education. I believe, Tom, that we have the resources in this country, if we so choose to use them in an effective way, so that every young person who wants to go to college would be able to go to college, tuition-free.
Yeah.
And if they don't want to go to college, they want to go to a trade school, we should be able to accomplish that, too.
For a fraction of the cost of the war in Iraq.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just a fraction.
We need to see our young people as the flower that is unfolding to become the beauty of this nation, and not just simply as fodder for the next war. We need to give our young people a chance to grow up in a world which is more peaceful and which is where energy policies do not threaten the future of the planet. Young people know when the future that's being prepared for them is being threatened, and we need to give them hope. And for people who are interested in this, they can go to my website at Kucinich.us.
Great. Kucinich.us. We'll be back with Congressman Dennis Kucinich and your calls after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio home of We the People, 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast and border to border, with Congressman Dennis Kucinich in the studio with us. Welcome back, Dennis.
Good to be here, Tom. Thanks for the chance to be on your show and with your audience.
It is so, so good to have you here. In fact, here's the... There you go.
Give me light, give me life, keep me. We could actually create that, actually.
Yeah. Even the keep me free from birth part. I mean, let us all get enlightened.
Well, the thought of a cabinet-level Department of Peace is a hopeful note in our democratic experience that we can actually create a culture of peace in America and make the everyday work of the nation the work that Dr. King dreamed about.
Amen. Well said. Keith in Hobbs, New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Keith, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. My question, my concern is, how do we take back the government from the corporate citizen and deliver it back to the average citizen? The corporate citizen seems to control Congress.
Well, campaign finance reform, if I may, Tom, it has to be on the agenda. I mean, if we have to have a public funding of federal elections, if you have public funding of federal election, you have public ownership of the government. Private funding of federal elections, private funding of the government. And we have right now a condition where corporations have enormous influence in bringing government decisions to their side. Jefferson warned about the money power. Lincoln warned about it. Eisenhower warned about corporations using their influence with the military. We have had leaders who have understood throughout the tradition, throughout the history of this country, that there has to be a strong stand for democracy as opposed to control by corporations.
What about a middle point? In Great Britain, my understanding is that if you're standing for Parliament, as a member of Parliament, you cannot spend more than £100,000, period.
Well, that makes sense. But again, that would be against some of the Supreme Court rulings that have equated
money with speech. Yeah, so they would give back to the First Amendment.
So we need to change the Constitution to provide for... to challenge that equation, number one. And number two, we need to have public financing and make that public financing the basis of the renewal of our country.
Yeah, well said. We have, Dennis, we're wrapping up the top of the hour, and I apologize to the callers that we have still on hold who wanted to talk to you. We're just out of time.
Well, Tom, if I may...
One final point.
Sure.
Please, go for it.
No, if I may, people can still get information at Kucinich.us, that's Kucinich.us, and we're interactive with people, and we'll keep you posted on not only the Department of Peace, but on health care, on protecting Social Security, and on getting out of Iraq.
Well said. Well done. Dennis Kucinich, one of America's great patriots, one of our statesmen, one of our true statesmen, as opposed to all the politicians running around loose. Thanks, Dennis.
Tom, thanks. Thanks to your listeners.
Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live all across this great nation of ours. You know, I saw an interesting psychological analysis. I'm not sure exactly what it would be at the Take Back America conference last week. It was a survey. Somebody was doing surveys, and they found that optimism is the value that is most often associated with patriotism, which is how Ronald Reagan got away with it. I mean, he had more people convicted of felonies during his administration than any president, senior officials, than any president in the history of the United States. And you know, policies that were openly anti-labor, openly anti-American, and yet was anti-environment and so on and so forth, and yet was viewed as patriotic. Fascinating stuff. Anyhow, welcome back to our program, live on radio stations from California to North Carolina on the Sirius Satellite Radio System, on RadioPower.org, White Rose Society, the American FM, and in 29 states on cable systems on CRN Digital. Welcome back. Glad to have you with us. Today, the Supreme Court ruled that medical marijuana laws, which have been passed in 10 states now, including Oregon, where from the place from which I'm broadcasting at this moment, that medical marijuana laws are that can be superseded by federal law. And so those folks who have gone to the trouble of getting a prescription from their doctor for medical marijuana and registering with the state, you know, whether they do it directly or their doctor does it, varies from state to state. Those people are now, by being on the state list of people who are allowed to have medical marijuana, presumably also now on the DEA's list of people whose doors should be kicked in next week. Or maybe. Let's get an expert opinion on this. Robert Campia, is it?
Yes, that's right.
Robert Campia is the executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project. What's your website there, Robert?
It's marijuanapolicy.org.
Well, that's pretty straightforward. And what's your take on this ruling?
The ruling isn't as bad as you would think.
Okay.
The ruling does not overturn the 10 state laws in the 10 states where medical marijuana is legal. What it does is it simply says that the feds can continue to use federal law to arrest patients and providers in states where medical marijuana is legal. It does not overturn the state laws. So what this means in real life is that if you're a patient in Oregon or California, medical marijuana is legal under state law, which means that local and state police are not allowed to arrest you. However, the feds can come in and arrest you under federal law. Now, that was the case before the Supreme Court ruled. So right. This actually isn't changing any law. It's just reinforcing the existing federal law.
Interesting. Would it be accurate to say that prior to the Civil War that states' rights always would have trumped, but that since the Civil War we've had kind of a new era of federalism and federal rights trump even in the face of the 10th Amendment?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Certainly over the course of the last few decades, the federal government has grabbed more and more power for itself, and the states are left holding the bag.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, this case, while disappointing, actually there's something to be happy about, which is that the timing of the case is perfect. What the court ruling said that if you want to have medical marijuana be legal, don't go to the Supreme Court for it. You have to go to Congress. And in fact, that's what we're doing. The U.S. House of Representatives is voting next week on our medical marijuana legislation. And this legislation, if it passes, it would forbid the DEA from spending taxpayer money to arrest patients and providers in states where it's legal.
Is this the legislation that was initially introduced by Barney Frank and Dana Rohrabacher?
There's two different ones. Barney Frank introduced a bill, which is a states' rights bill, and that's pending. Mm-hmm. But there's an amendment that's coming up on the House floor, which is similar to that, which is an amendment to the Justice Department spending bill. And that amendment is introduced by Maurice Hinchey and Dana Rohrabacher.
Yeah, and with an amendment, it's a little easier if you attach it to a must-have piece of legislation. Sometimes you can slip all kinds of things through, as Bill Frist, you know, is so famous for doing with his "Let There Be Mercury in Vaccines" thing. That it took us 10 months to figure out who even attached that thing to an appropriations bill.
Yeah, the nice thing about this is that because the Justice Department spending bill has to come up for a vote next week, and the good guys in Congress, anyone in Congress, have the right to attach any amendment to it, that we're guaranteed a vote.
Right, right.
And so if anyone's interested in telling their House member how to vote, they should go to marijuanapolicy.org and send a letter to their House member.
Marijuanapolicy.org. Or you can simply call your member of the House of Representatives toll-free. It doesn't cost a penny. You can do it right now. You can call your member of the House of Representatives by calling 1-877, toll-free, 1-877-SOB, the letter U, S-O-B. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the toll-free number for Congress. Honest to goodness, I'm not making it up. It really is. It's the old Senate office building number, actually, which is where it came from. But in any case,
if you're going to call Congress, as you're going to call your U.S. House member, the message is that you want them to vote yes on the Hinchey-Rohrabacher Medical Marijuana Amendment.
Hinchey-Rohrabacher Medical Marijuana Amendment.
To the Justice Department spending bill, period.
Right. Okay. Now, a question. We're talking with Robert Campia of the Executive Director of the Marijuana Policy Project. And Robert, how does the Supreme Court come to this ruling in the face of the 10th Amendment, which basically says that, well, in fact, I've got the 10th Amendment right here. Yeah, I do. The powers not delegated by the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Right.
And the Constitution doesn't say you can't smoke pot. In fact, George Washington was growing the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I'm not going to try to defend their opinion because I don't agree with it, but I'll at least try to give them a fair shake at articulating what I think they're trying to get at.
Okay.
And that is that they say that, of course, marijuana is a product in society that is obviously used in interstate commerce. It's going trafficked all across the country. There's a $10 billion market for it. There's a couple of patients in California who raised this case and said, hey, we want to be able to grow a couple of plants in our living rooms. It's not affecting interstate commerce. It's just intrastate, small-time medical marijuana use.
So the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which does give the federal government the ability to regulate commerce between the states, would not apply.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it is true. I know these patients personally. They really aren't engaging in interstate commerce. They're just a couple of sick people in Oakland and Northern California who have a small amount of marijuana, and they don't leave their homes, except when they have to do TV interviews. And so this is basically one of the things that the Supreme Court just said is it's hard for police when they're knocking down your door to know what you're going to do with the marijuana. Are you in fact engaged in interstate commerce or are you in fact engaged in just home use? And because it's hard for the police to tell how each person around the country is going to be using their marijuana, it's just an impossible burden to put on them, and therefore we have to keep marijuana illegal under federal law for the entire country.
Well, during the Warren Court, when the Miranda ruling came down, the presumption was if we're going to err, we err on the side of the rights of the citizens and the presumed innocence of the citizens. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that this court is saying if we're going to err, we're going to err on the side of police power.
That's right.
And police convenience.
It's exactly right, police convenience. And so we want to make it easy for the police. And if the cancer patients have to suffer and die in the meantime, well, that's the price you pay for living in the U.S.
And this is, I mean, this, oh boy, this is another good reason why, I mean, this is why you've got the conservatives so hysterical. Bill Frist and all these, you know, the Justice Sunday folks and the Focus on the Family folks, so that they want to pack the court because they want more of this. We've got three turncoats from their point of view now, Sandra Day O'Connor and two others who have said, hang on just a minute, maybe we should consider the rights of the people. And I don't think people get it until it strikes home how important the Supreme Court really is and these decisions really are.
That's right. And, you know, we're just happy that they didn't overreach. The Supreme Court decision was a narrow decision that only said that the feds can continue doing what they are doing, which is using federal law to arrest a few medical marijuana clinics here and there every year. In the meantime, patients are pretty much safe in the 10 states where it's legal. Because let's face it, there's only a few thousand DEA agents in the entire country, but there are tens of thousands. Actually, there's probably way more than 100,000 patients using medical marijuana just on the West Coast alone.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, look at how many people are buying or selling bongs, and they dragged off Tommy Chong. I mean, they're always going to try and make an example of somebody.
They make an example out of someone who's really high profile. So if you're a cancer patient or an AIDS patient and you're not high profile and you're using marijuana at home legally under state law, the state and the local cops can't get you.
But the feds can.
They can and they won't, because the feds don't kick in people's doors for growing or smoking a small amount of marijuana.
They don't.
They don't. And in fact, the FBI reports that 99% of all marijuana arrests in the country are made by state and local police.
Yeah.
Not the feds.
So your message is, let's not get hysterical about this. Let's just get active.
Correct. And it's a time to get active, because next week is the vote in Congress. So if you care about this issue, now's the time to call your House member and tell them to vote yes on the medical marijuana amendment.
Right. By dialing 1-877-SOB-USOB and asking for your specific member of the House of Representatives. We're talking with Robert Campia, who is the executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project. Robert, in the 2 minutes or so that we have left here, could you just really quickly capsulize for our listeners who may not be familiar with medical marijuana as a concept, why it's important that people, that medical marijuana be available?
It's important because the FDA has already approved a pill, Marinol, which has the primary active ingredient of marijuana in the pill, and that's THC. So we already know that marijuana has medical value because the FDA has approved this pill. However, if you're vomiting and you're nauseous and you need relief from your nausea, you don't really want to take a pill because you're just going to vomit it up. And so it's important to be able to eat or to smoke or to vaporize marijuana so you get immediate relief.
And one of the main reasons, in fact, that people use pot in chemotherapy is to deal with nausea.
That's right. And in fact, marijuana doesn't cure your disease. What it does is it increases your appetite and reduces the nausea so that you can actually survive your chemotherapy treatments or your AIDS treatment drugs, so you're not vomiting yourself to death. You get through your chemotherapy, and then you're able to live a normal life. And at that point, you can stop smoking marijuana.
Yeah.
But people use marijuana to get through the treatments. Also, with multiple sclerosis, patients use marijuana to reduce the pain and the spasticity associated with the muscle spasms that MS patients suffer from.
Hasn't it also been demonstrated to slow the progression of MS?
There is some evidence of that, yes. Although it's not as well demonstrated as the immediate relief that MS patients get.
You know,
might be aware that the most famous MS patient now is Montel Williams.
Oh, interesting. No, I didn't know that.
He has MS. He smokes marijuana illegally every day to treat MS. He says he couldn't do his TV show if he didn't actually use marijuana.
Huh. And he talks about this on his TV show?
He had me on his TV show a couple months ago talking about it with him.
Interesting.
And he's been lobbying in Congress, and he's been lobbying in Albany, New York, to try to change federal law and the state law. He lives in New York, and he doesn't want to be a criminal in his home state.
That's great. Robert Campia, thank you so much for being with us, Robert. I appreciate it. The executive director of the Marijuana Policy Project, marijuanapolicy.org. Check out the website. You can drop a note to your member of Congress, find out what's going on. We have legislation coming up next week that's going to be voted on. You need to get active right now, marijuanapolicy.org. Thank you again, Robert.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning.
Yeah, good plan.
I'd a hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd a hammer out danger.
As it is 25 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room. A fascinating conversation going on in there. And it just you know, so much happening in the news these days. It is really, really quite extraordinary. It really, really and truly is, it seems, I think. It's, now, somewhere I've got... No, it's not coming through. Ah, well. Anyhow, we have a Bolton alert here for you. Bolton provoked unlawful firing. John Bolton provoked an unlawful firing? This, you know, this is big news. This is very interesting here. This, when you look at what is it that they're trying to hide? You know, what are these guys trying to cover up? Why is it that they don't want anything about John Bolton going out? You know, why not? Well, it turns out that John Bolton flew to Europe in 2002 to confront the head of a global arms control agency, writes Charles Hanley in the Associated Press, and demand he resign. And then he orchestrated the firing of the unwilling diplomat in a move a UN tribunal has since judged unlawful, according to officials involved. Now, why? Why would John Bolton be doing this? Turns out, this guy was about to blow their cover. I mean, that's the real Bolton alert here. The real story behind the story is that this guy was about to blow their cover. He was about to point out that it's all phony, that they just made it all up, that there's nothing to it, that it's that it ain't real, as they say, that there's in fact, excuse me, it's, I'm trying to do two things at once here. This guy he's from Brazil. His name is Jose Bustani. And he was trying to send chemical weapons inspectors to Baghdad. Now, this was at the time that the Bush administration was trying to gin up the war. They were getting all hysterical. Hey, we've got to have a war. We've got to do it right away. We've got to, you know, blah, 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 blah. There's got to be a war. And in the middle of this, this guy, Jose Bustani, this Brazilian diplomat, says, okay, if you guys are saying that there's no weapons of mass or that there are weapons of mass destruction, that there are chemical weapons, we've got an expert. We've got a guy who really knows chemical weapons, really knows how to find them. We're going to track this, and we're going to get this guy, and we're going to send him over to Iraq, and we'll know in a matter of a few weeks whether or not Iraq has any chemical weapons left. Now, keep in mind, Saddam Hussein had turned over 14,000 pages documenting the destruction of his weapons of mass destruction. The United States, the Bush administration, redacted some 5,000 of those pages, covered them up with black ink, because in all probability, we will never know, because they've classified them, but in all probability, the reason why was because those are the pages where it talked about Don Rumsfeld being the guy who was facilitating the sale of these weapons to Saddam Hussein by the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. So we knew that they weren't there. Bolton knew that they weren't there. And this guy, this diplomat, Jose Bustani, was going to blow the whistle on Bolton and Bush. He was going to say, he was going to prove that there was nothing there that was worth 1,600, 1,700 American kids dying, 10, 20,000 of them losing limbs, and 100,000 Iraqis dying. There was nothing there that was worth that cost, not to mention $300 billion. Nothing there. And that would have gotten in the way of George Bush's reelection plans. That would have gotten in the way of the Republicans trying to take the House and the Senate, trying to get the Senate back in 2002. And it would have gotten in the way of George Bush wanting to have his reelection in 2004. And the war in Iraq was the centerpiece of both strategies. So John Bolton went out and he fired this guy. He had this guy fired. And why this is not the lead story in every newspaper in America right now baffles me completely. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is with us with our report from Washington, D.C. for the day. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, how are you?
Fine. What's up there?
Well, we had this interesting hearing from the 9/11 Commission, an update. You know, 1 year on, they're going to be holding them every week now for about the next 8 or 9 weeks on different aspects. Just briefly, this morning's was about the FBI and the CIA, and some of it was encouraging. The people they had on, the experts they had on, seemed to indicate some things are being done. But in terms of an overall view, the rivalry between the FBI and Homeland Security and the police exists. Our virtual file caseload apparently is an absolute disaster, and we're years and years behind, and we're behind on human intelligence. And so, I mean, you know, all the things that you would hope that we might have fixed, we're finding extremely difficult to fix.
Well, it's only been 3 years. I mean, the Bush administration, I guess.
Well, they're looking at it from the point of view of 1 year.
I was just going to say, you know, well, it's been 3 years since 9/11, and this administration has done what? They've come up with a color code system.
Right, and there was the duct tape, too.
Oh, yes, let us not forget, we never forget the duct tape.
No, never forget the duct tape.
Vital stuff.
It is, it's vital.
Yeah,
it's vital.
Okay. So, and what else is happening in Washington?
Well, of course,
we had the Supreme Court. Right,
yes,
yeah.
The Supreme Court is a busy little court today, at the same time saying that cruise ships must provide access for the disabled. It's at the same time saying that those who are disabled by pain can be prosecuted for smoking dope in their homes.
Yeah. Specifically marijuana, yeah.
Specifically marijuana. But the indication seems to be, it almost sounds as though the court is trying to push this one back on Congress and to get Congress to maybe move to legalize this under certain circumstances.
Yeah, interesting. We had a fellow on from the Marijuana Policy Institute just a few minutes ago talking about that.
I was thinking in terms of, with the stem cell research debate, and finding that many of the pro-lifers in the Senate and in the House who traditionally vote with the president on all these issues have broken with him on that. I think we might see a number of the same people breaking with him when it comes to issues of pain management.
It would make sense. It just would make sense. It'll be interesting to see where Bill Frist stands on this as a physician.
Yes.
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 He'll stand wherever he thinks he's going to get the most votes from the religious right.
Right, exactly. And in this case, you know, sometimes the religious right is the vote that counts, and sometimes if you've got millions and millions of other Americans who are conservative on everything else, but actually I guess in this case could be considered conservative with a small c.
Yeah, yeah.
Smaller government and keeping the feds out of your house.
Yeah, well, that's become the Democratic Party's position. I mean, it's amazing to watch over a 30-year arc, to watch all these positions reverse themselves. Okay, Victoria Jones, thanks so much for your report today.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. In just a few minutes, we have a rush alert coming up. Lots of other interesting news for you. Mary in Grand Rapids on the line first. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Yes, mentioning Bill Frist again. You mentioned about his position on vaccinations and mercury.
Yeah.
What was it tied to, and what was it about?
Well, a year and a half or 2 years ago, there was an attachment, a little one sentence rider that was built into about a 4,000-page, you know, omnibus spending bill. End of the year, got to pass one of these giant things, you know, that goes through Congress like a truck and nobody reads it. And that one sentence, or maybe it was two or three sentences, but that very brief sentence said basically that if it is found that the mercury-based preservatives used in vaccines, and I believe it's pronounced Thermisol, Thermisol, is the most common one, that if it is found that these mercury-based preservatives in the vaccines cause autism or any other problem with children, then we, the people of the United States, the citizens who are affected by this, no longer have the right to sue the manufacturer, even if they can prove that the manufacturer knew about this risk. And for at least 8 or 10 months, there was a group, and I believe, I want to say it was MoveOn.org, it might have been People for the American Way, one of the progressive groups was offering a $10,000 reward to anybody who could figure out which member of Congress had introduced that, had attached that to that spending bill, because it was this huge, it saved the vaccine industry potentially at least hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars. And it turned out that finally after 8 or 10 months, they figured out who it was, and it was Bill Frist.
That's kind of interesting, because there was a recent study done with an Amish community where if they had been in the general community, 90 children would have had autism.
Right.
And yet the only three they could find were at least two had been vaccinated, and the third they weren't sure. But
right.
none of the other Amish children had any autism.
Right. And along with the rise of mercury in these vaccines and mercury in our environment, which George Bush would like to see more of rather than less of, we also have an explosion in autism across the United States right now. It's a major national epidemic, and I think we can track it right back to this stuff. Mary, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm hoping I got the good information here. Last night I was listening to Ray Taliaferro, who says that today John Kerry will make a presentation before the Senate, in effect a questioning, as John Conyers says, the after the Downey Street issues and bringing it up.
You know, I read that as well, and it was in a local newspaper. I forget where the paper was, but Kerry had been in some town somewhere in the United States, and he'd given an interview to a local reporter, and that local, and there was a link off BuzzFlash.com to it, and that local newspaper reporter said that Kerry told him that when he got back to Congress over the weekend on Monday, the first thing he was going to do was he was going to raise the Downing Street memo on the floor of the Senate. And Mark Crispin Miller, actually, he was the first one to share that with me, and in email. And then later I got another email from him saying, well, we don't know yet if this is a Vanishing Hitchhiker story or not. And then we were able to track down the original story, but we don't know if the guy was credible. And so everybody's waiting to see if John Kerry's going to do something. I'm not holding my breath, frankly.
Well, that would be a good thing, I think, if he did it. He's been conceding the election and then staying quiet for long.
Yeah, John Kerry has... I don't know. He's winning the doormat award this year or something. I'm sorry. I voted for him. I recommended that people vote for him and work for him. And I think that there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, in fact, that he would make a very, very good president compared to George Bush in particular. I think, but even in a vacuum, I think John Kerry would be a good president. But I'm not sure that he's a good candidate. I'm sorry. Dave.
Redeem himself today if there's anything to this.
We'll see. And if he does, then it might go a long way toward helping his presidential aspirations next time around. But like I said, I'm not holding my breath on that one. But, you know, time will tell. I mean, it is, it's only the middle of the afternoon now in Washington, D.C., so, you know, perhaps, yeah, the folks in the the folks that are in our chat room keeping track of this, and I do appreciate that. It's good to have you there, and good to have you keeping track of these things. So, time for a rush alert, our Limbaugh alert, as it were, or no, our rush alert for the day. Here we go, and no, it's still ain't working. Okay, here's our Limbaugh alert for the day. There it is. So, different pot. Things have moved around.
Descending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this. They always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm not serious.
Yes, indeed, it's our Rush Alert music. You see, you go to the studio for 4 days, you come back and they change everything all around here. Anyhow, nationally syndicated radio talk show host Rush Bimbo declared that the Democratic Party's plan to make Election Day a national holiday, outlined by Howard Dean at the Take Back America conference, where I was broadcasting live from last week, quote, won't help them that much because, quote, most of their voters don't work anyway.
McCarthy like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-at-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the Democratic trasher, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a pig, I'm a fat, obnoxious pig, and the truth of the matter is, I'm
vomiting. Yes, our Limbaugh alert for the day. Yes. Now, of course, where he's coming from on this is that Howard Dean, here you got Rush Limbaugh saying Democrats don't work. And, of course, what he's trying to imply is that they're on welfare. And Howard Dean at the Take Back America conference had given his speech, and he actually made the a comment. He said, and I quote, he said, well, Republicans, he's talking about why Republicans are opposed to Election Day being a national holiday. Now, oddly, that context, that fact, does not get reported in the mainstream media. Doesn't. It's just, I haven't seen one single mention of the fact that what Dean was talking about was making voting day a national holiday where everybody gets the day off. Make it like a Saturday. Right? It just, it's a national holiday, like Christmas. It's a national holiday. And in that context, somebody asked him, or he was rhetorically pontificating about, you know, why is it that the Republicans are opposed to making voting day a national holiday? And Dean said, and I quote, well, Republicans, I guess, can do that. That is, keep it a working day so they could go vote. He says, well, Republicans, I guess, can do that because a lot of them have never made an honest living in their lives. But for ordinary working people, those who have to work 8 hours a day, they have kids, they got to get home to those kids. The idea of making them stand for 8 hours to cast their ballot for democracy is wrong. You get this? It's pretty straightforward. And, you know, just like Limbaugh is saying, well, you got Democrats who are on welfare. That's the stereotype the Republicans like to promulgate. Dean was promulgating a stereotype, and that is the Walton family sitting, you know, the people who earn their living, in quotes, sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. And there are more than a few of them out there. But, you know, I'll give you that it was really dumb of Howard Dean to say that the way he said it. You know, politically, in terms of political correctness, it was really dumb. And yet, at the same time, there is some truth to it. And so he's defending himself. He's sticking to his guns, as they say on CNN. Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean is defending remarks he made that enraged Republican leaders. He said in an interview with Wolf Blitzer, he says, I don't hate Republicans. I sure hate what this Republican Party is doing to America. And then his speech in Friday's interview, Dean said that he did not intend his remarks to refer to the more than 50 million Americans who voted for President Bush, but rather to Republican leaders whom he said do not understand the difficulties of waiting in line for 8 hours to vote, as some did in Florida during the last election, or 10 or 12 hours, as some did in Ohio. He said, we don't go after voters, but we go after bad leadership. And he cited the national deficit and the war in Iraq as evidence of the Republican administration's incompetence. Now, again, you're not going to hear this. The media has this tendency to create a caricature, a cartoon figure of a person or a personality. You know, to try and reduce everybody down to a cartoon, to a caricature, down to a cartoon character. And then whenever they behave in a way that's at all consistent or could even be remotely construed as consistent with that caricature, then they trot that out and they say, see, we told you so. We were right. We got it. This is it. Sure enough. So. But on the right, somehow doesn't get reported. Here you have Laura Ingraham, the radio talk show host, and I got to say, very strange person. I debated at the Heritage Foundation last year. Boy, is she strange. Anyhow, exit poll data show, well, let me first, what she said. She said, Republicans are clearly connecting with the regular people, where the Democrats are not. Okay? The regular people. Now, when conservative talk show hosts say regular people, who are they talking about? I mean, if you look at people who earn $15,000 to $30,000 a year, carry one by 15 percentage points. If you're talking about African Americans, carry one over Bush by an 8-to-1 margin. Women, Hispanics, Jews, gays, lesbians, all supported Kerry over Bush by an overwhelming margin. This from the exit poll data. And white males earning $15,000 to $30,000 all supported Kerry over Bush. Now, who were Bush's main supporters? Again, looking at the exit poll data, his largest margin of victory, his single largest margin of victory, came from people making more than $200,000 a year. $200,000 to $300 million a year. That was Bush's number one, the largest group that voted for him. His second largest was those making $150,000 to $200,000 a year. His third largest was among those making $100,000 to $150,000 a year. Meanwhile, Kerry's biggest win was between those making $30,000 and $50,000 a year, and his second biggest was between those making $15,000 to $30,000 a year. But Laura Ingraham would tell you, and the right-wingers will tell you, and I'm sure Bimbo will be, you know, all these guys will be talking about this. You know, Howard Dean, they've lost touch with the regular people. The regular people being, in the minds of folks like Ingraham and Hannity and Limbaugh and all these bloviating millionaires, people who make over $200,000 a year, over $1 million a year, over $5 million a year. Those are the regular people, in their mind. Yeah. Yeah. What's wrong with that picture? Speaking of which, it's a fascinating piece in the New York Times here about what's happening as the consequence of conservative economic policies. We saw it in the 1920s, during the so-called Roaring Twenties, when the vast majority of Americans, well over 90% of Americans, were earning less than, in today's dollars, less than $9,800 a year. And we're seeing it now. We'll get to that right after this break. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The New York Times has been running this piece on class and class structure and wealth in the United States. And just a remarkable piece on June 5th that has been adding to this over the weekend. When F. Scott Fitzgerald, by David K. Johnson, when F. Scott Fitzgerald pronounced that the very rich are different from you and me, Ernest Hemingway's famously dismissive response was, yes, they have more money. Today, however, he might add much, much, much more money. And then the New York Times goes to point out the top 1,000th, 145,000 taxpayers all have at least $1.6 million a year in income, averaged $3 million in 2002. That number is 2.5 times what they made in 1980. No other income group rose nearly as fast, particularly during the Bush years. The share of the nation's income earned by those in this uppermost category has more than doubled since 1980. They go on to say the Bush administration tax cuts stand to widen the gap between the hyper-rich and the rest of America. The merely rich, making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, will shoulder a disproportionate share of the tax burden. Under the Bush tax cut, the 400 taxpayers with the highest income, a minimum of $87 million in 2000, the last year for which there was government data. In other words, the 400 people who make at least $87 million a year now pay income taxes, Medicare, and Social Security taxes amounting to virtually the same percentage of their income as people making $50,000 a year. Those earning more than $10 million a year now pay less of their income in taxes than those making $100,000 a year. The hyper-rich, the New York Times notes, have emerged in the last three decades as the biggest winners in a remarkable transformation of the American economy, characterized by, among other things, the creation of a more global marketplace, spurred partly by tax cuts. They add from 1950 to 1970, for example, for every additional dollar earned by the bottom 90%, those in the top 1/100th of 1% earned an additional $162. That was from 1950 to 1970. However, from 1990 to today, for every extra dollar earned by those in the bottom 90%, every taxpayer in the top 1/100th of 1% earned an extra $18,000. An IRS study found that the only taxpayers whose share of taxes declined in the first 2 years of the Bush administration were those in the top 1/10th of 1%. Surprise, surprise! As Warren Buffett said, yes, the second richest man in America, yes, there is class warfare in America, and my class is winning. Or his class, shall we say. And George Bush, speaking to a group of very wealthy donors, he says, I see we have here the haves and the have-mores. Some call you the elite, I call you my base. Is it time for us to reevaluate tax policy in the United States? We'll get into that in the next hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org. RadioPower.org, American FM on Live365.com, and in 29 states on CRN Digital in cable systems. Welcome back to our program. Wanted to get into a little bit of American history and how it plays out today. You know, what's going on with it today, how it's being played out. First, just want to let you know, that Dave in Humboldt County, one of our regular callers and listeners, just sent me a note saying that he had called John Kerry's office and asked, is Senator Kerry going to mention on the floor of the Senate the Downing Street memo? And was told, probably not today, but he intends to do it. So I guess that's good news. You might want to call Senator Kerry's office and say, how about today anyway? Or how about tomorrow morning first thing? Or how about doing it? You know, and calling a press conference and inviting Good Morning America to show up. You know, turn it into infotainment. Why not stand up and wave it around and start yelling treason? Why not bring in a bunch of you know, armless, legless veterans who have lost their limbs as a consequence of a war that George Bush lied us into so that the Republicans could take control of the Senate in 2000 and he could get himself elected in 2004. You can call Senator Kerry's office by calling 1-877-SOB-USOB. Nothing personal. That'll reach any member of Congress. 1-877, toll free, 1-877-SOB, as in Senate Office Building, SOB, the letter U, as in United States of America, SOB. SOB, USOB, 1-877. That'll get you there. And you can call and let them know what you think. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to call into the program, tomhartman.com. Click live chat if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, or blog and message board if you want to have a more permanent message and engage in a conversation, a kind of an ongoing conversation. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I have a couple questions I wanted to ask. First of all, do you think it's consensus among the Democrats that the election of 2004 was stolen, or do you think that they think it was a fair election?
I honestly don't have a clue.
I mean, the Democrats in Congress. You know?
Yeah, the only member of Congress that I've had any conversation with about this at all is Dennis Kucinich, and that was this morning on this program. And, you know, Dennis is not coming out and saying the election was stolen. I don't think that anybody can, absolutely. I know we had John Conyers on the program back before he'd started his hearings in Ohio, and he was very concerned. You read the Conyers Commission report, and again, they don't come out and say the election was stolen. But when you figure that the election was decided by about 60,000 voters in Ohio, and Conyers has documented several hundred thousand stolen votes, all of them on behalf of George Bush, every single one of the hundreds of election errors and frauds and crimes, and they use the word crimes, by the way, in this report that they found in the Conyers Commission report, which is now out as a book called What Went Wrong in Ohio. It's only 126 pages. You can read it in an afternoon. Every single one of them worked to the benefit of George Bush. Now, if that's not, you know, election crime, election fraud, then I don't know what is, but
okay. Well, I just hope that they can, like, you know, get together and talk to each other, so at least they are on one page with it, because it seems like they're just got their head in the sand with that one.
Yeah, or someplace else. Yeah, I agree with you, Logan.
But one more question is about fascism. It seems like you compare the fascism that we're going through now to the Mussolini fascism, but it seems like there is a difference, and this is a new kind that isn't really as collective as Mussolini's was. In many respects, it was like workers owning their own corporate area or something. That seemed to be his strategy, Mussolini. But ours is like much more top-down driven and much more nefarious.
Yeah, it's actually more insidious. Mussolini,
right.
Although, keep in mind, dissolved parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascisio Corporaciones, or however you say it in Italian, the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. And so if you lived in Erie, Pennsylvania, then your representative wouldn't be Joe Blow, who you elected. It would be Joe Doe, who was the corporate representative of U.S. Steel. And whatever was the largest corporation in a region, that was who went to represent that region. And, you know, Mussolini was just right up front about it. He thought that this was the best way to run a country and that it would provide for stability. I mean, the fasce was their symbol, their logo. The fasce is a bundle of sticks with an axe sticking out of the top of it. There's actually one carved on the speaker's platform in the United States Senate. And it's an old Roman symbol. It's the old symbol of the Roman Empire. And Mussolini's point was, you know, a single stick can be broken, a bundle of sticks can't be broken. And so he thought that the most powerful, outside of government, the most powerful force in society was the corporate force. And so he was going to merge corporations and government together and thus produce a government that would survive any kind of an assault on it, that would, you know, that would be stable for a long, long period of time. And that's a, you know, it's a laudable goal to try and have a stable government. But if you're going to accomplish it by throwing out democracy and throwing out the will of the people, and instead of having a corporate aristocracy, I don't think it's I just don't think it's a good idea. And time has demonstrated that Mussolini, you know, he was right over the short term and wrong over the long term, as is so often the case with conservatives and these kinds of, you know, these kinds of programs. And so what we have now here in the United States, instead of having dissolved the House of Representatives and the Senate and said, okay, we're going to replace them with representatives of major corporations, we have people who are only elected by virtue of the fact that they can buy enough television advertising to get elected, and the only place they can get the money is from the corporation. So now we have, you know, two steps removed, but indirectly, we still have, you know, Bill Frist represents the pharma industry, and, you know, and you could just go down the list who represents which industries.
I got you, yeah.
Okay. So, you know,
thanks for that explanation.
You're welcome, Logan. Thanks for the call. So, you know, is it fascism that we have here? I wouldn't say definitely. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, if you define fascism as the American Heritage Dictionary did in 1987, the year before it was bought out by a multinational corporation, and they changed the definition. But if you use the classic definition of fascism, which was first invented and written by Benito Mussolini, who invented the word, of the merging of business and state interests, then we're quite a ways down the road. We're quite a ways down the road. And in fact, that's which gets me back to what I wanted to share with you in this segment of the program, and that is, you know, some of the historic perspective on this. You know, how have presidents of the United States historically talked about this? You go back to 1913, and one of the first recordings that Thomas Edison himself made of the former president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, talking about conservatives.
I prefer to work with moderate, with rational conservatives, provided only that they do in good faith strive forward toward the light. But when they halt and turn their backs to the light, sit with the scorners on the seats of reaction, then I must part company with them.
Then I must part company with them, says Teddy Roosevelt. And this, you know, this was his concern about conservatives. So then Franklin Roosevelt comes along, and he points out that, you know, we've entered a new time in the United States.
That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power.
Now, see, this is a really important concept, that if you're going to talk about liberty, you know, George Bush is running around the world talking about democracy's on the march, freedom, 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 freedom. Freedom from what? You know, freedom from what? What kind of freedom are we talking about here? Well, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, asked that question. If you're going to use the word freedom, you have to say freedom from what? What are we talking about freedom from in the United States?
In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy.
So, okay, back then it was King George. We didn't want to be, you know, we wanted to be free of a kingdom, of a political power.
From the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown.
Okay, so very clearly we fought the Revolutionary War against the royalists, those who held special, you know, they got their power from the king. Now, what about today? Now, keep in mind, this is 1936, July 1936, that FDR made this speech. And he says, but things have changed since 1776.
But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free.
Uh-huh. So things changed, and we have now a new economic order, and yet we still want to talk about freedom. How do we remain free in the face of this new order? This, as George Bush Sr. would call it, this new world order.
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things.
So he's saying, Franklin Roosevelt now saying, you know, we worried about King George before. We've got new kings now. They're called, you know, Carnegie and Ford and Mellon and Scaife and, you know, on it goes.
Through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service.
Impressed, you'll recall, those of you who are students of history, where they used to literally come to people's homes and say, you are going to be in the army. It wasn't even a draft. It was impressed. You are going to be grabbed and taken into this service, into this royal service. And what did that royal service mean? And how do we respond to it? What kind of new royalty has emerged in the United States? Franklin Roosevelt identified it. And what's so amazing to me is that if you talk to people who remember Franklin Roosevelt, and there still are a few of them around, and you talk to people who remember FDR, that generation understood the issues. This generation doesn't. This generation, the people, I would say, under the age of 40, certainly, in the United States, don't remember. You know, people 50, 60 probably don't remember Franklin Roosevelt, but people under the age of 40 grew up in a school system where we weren't even teaching the perspectives that were widely known, that were broadly understood back in the 1930s, about the difference of where power lies in the United States, how power flows in the United States, and how economics and power are tied together, how economics and political power are tied together. And so I want to share with you Franklin Roosevelt's thoughts about that, because it's so important that we remember these lessons. I'll be right back. Tom Hartman with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, indeed. If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman radio program, 25 minutes past the hour. Franklin Roosevelt. It is so important. I realize that just a few months ago, One of the right-wing bloviators, well, specifically Rush Limbaugh, came out and said, you know, get over it. Roosevelt is dead, and his policies live on, but we're doing something about that. And, of course, what he was talking about is that the conservative agenda is to destroy Social Security. Yeah, but how did this come about? What brought this about? So here we have Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, saying, you know, in 1776 we fought against a king. Now there's a new royal force that we again must fight against. Franklin Roosevelt.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
And this was, you know, well known. I mean, it was just broadly understood. This is what brought about the Great Depression. So what do we do about it, Mr. Roosevelt?
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
And see, this is what they're saying all over again. They're saying, you know, Social Security, get rid of that. Minimum wage?
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
And this is the debate that we're coming back to now at this point in time. And this is the crucial debate of our era. Do we have a right to work, or is it a privilege? Is society organized to encourage business because business will work in a way that benefits society? Or does business operate independent of the needs of society? You know, nobody's talking about these issues. And this is, and everybody was talking about these issues in the 1930s and in the 1880s and in the 1770s. It's like every 70 years, it comes back around. Every 70 years. It's absolutely remarkable. Back to Mr. Roosevelt.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And see, that's, and even today, the same thing. That's really what they're saying, is that they want the power. And Roosevelt said,
our allegiance. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
You get that? Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. And today, again, we are celebrating. Here we see, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission. You had Donaldson in there, who Bush thought was safe. You know, the guy's not, he's an old Bush family friend. He's in his 70s. He's a multimillionaire. He's a Wall Street insider. He's not going to enforce the rules. No, no way. So what? He starts enforcing the rules. He starts holding corporate crooks accountable. He starts saying to these economic royalists that Roosevelt was talking about, he starts saying to them, you have to play by the rules. Sorry, you've got to, you must play by the rules. If you don't, you will be held accountable. So what does the Bush administration do? They say, enough of you, Mr. Donaldson. You are toast. We are going to replace you with Mr. Cox, who we know will not enforce the rules. He has a long history of being on the side of the rule breakers, not the rule makers. Of the economic royalists, not we the people. We're back there again. I'm telling you, it is looking so much like the late 20s. Economically, you look at the concentration of wealth that the New York Times is writing about, you look at their graphics, we're right back there again. Are we on the edge of a crash? We'll see. 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing
democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's tit for tat, but heck, you know all that. So when George number one brought in the big guns and chased me out of Kuwait, tried to set me straight.
Oh, it's the Saddam song from Jim Turr from BlueCanyonSatire.com. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. If you'd like to drop into the live chat room, just click live chat, and you can hang out with some of the finest minds in the whole entire internet. Fascinating discussion right now about fascism and the nature of fascism when things changed in America. And I'm telling you, this is nothing new. What we are experiencing right now is nothing new. I just want to wrap up. This is from Franklin Roosevelt's speech on July 27th, 1936, his acceptance speech when he was renominated to run for president of the United States at the Democratic Party, Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, as I recall. And so he sets it up by saying the first revolution in the United States, the first Revolutionary War, was fought against the Royalists of King George. And then after that, a new order of royalists rose up in America, the robber barons, the captains of industry, who weren't satisfied just making money. They wanted to reach out and capture the levers of government as well. They wanted to seize control of the levers of power. Why? Well, some because they were power hungry. Most, however, because that's another way to enhance profits. If you can control the rules by which the game is made, if you're the referee in the game in which you're playing, then you're more likely to win that game. Especially if you can skew the rules so that your opponents, you know, any small company that might want to compete with you, gets blown away. This is one of the reasons, if you go back and you look, and I wrote about this in my book on equal protection, during the first Bush administration, Bush Sr., Monsanto was developing their genetically modified products. There were no genetically modified products on the market at the time. They were developing them, and they went to Bush himself. He was vice president. Actually, this is the last years of the Reagan administration. He was vice president. They went to Bush, and they said, "We want to have regulation of these products." Now, why would a big corporation want regulation? I thought, you know, everybody think you hear all these cons talking, excessive regulation, here, too many regulations, we can't have these regulations. Well, some regulations the cons really don't like. They don't like the fact that power companies have to, you know, can't spew poison into the air, that chemical companies can't spew poisons into the water. It reduces profits. But there are other regulations that they not only like and want, but they actually seek out. For example, there's two reasons for this. The first is that it allows them to wipe out their competition. For example, there are some industries where the industries have asked for regulation so that the rules are sufficiently complex that a small business simply can't afford the cost of entry. So what happens is the great big companies that dominate the industry will always dominate the industry because a small company can't afford to get into it. The bar has been set too high. So number one, regulation to keep competition out. And number two, regulation to legitimize, to make legal something that might otherwise be illegal. You say, what? Most people think of regulations as things that make things illegal. Well, let me give you an example. Let's say that you own a gold mine, and they use arsenic in gold mining to separate the gold from the ore around it. They inject, you know, arsenic into the water, into the slurry that they mix the gold up with, and that water then ends up in the streams and rivers. And so you own a gold mine, and you're emitting water into the rivers, and that water contains arsenic. Now, if somebody downriver drinks out of that river, or their well gets poisoned because their well is the result of that river percolating through the soil and filling an aquifer underneath it, and they get arsenic in their drinking water, and their child is you know, born with birth defects, or they die as a result of long-term low-level arsenic poisoning, they have a cause against you in court. They can go into court and say, this company put this arsenic in my water, and look at the results. So the companies that were in the business of using arsenic went to the United States and said, regulate arsenic, please. So the government said, okay, if you produce more than 10 parts per billion of arsenic in the water, if the water coming out of your plant has more than 10 parts per billion, then you're in violation of the law. If it has less than 10 parts per billion, you're legal. So if you're in the business and you know that you can produce 9 parts per billion, you can now put arsenic in the water and nobody can sue you. No, even if they're harmed, they can't do anything about it because you are complying with the regulations. You get it? You get how this works? And very often, in fact, the regulations are changed to protect industry. I remember I lived in Germany in 1986. This is not unique to the United States. I was living in Germany in 86 and 87. In fact, we moved there a week after Chernobyl melted down, the first week of May. I was in Germany when the first cloud came over and the first rains, the first radioactive rains were falling in Frankfurt. And it was amazing. The whole city was like a ghost town. Nobody went out. I was walking from the train station to a hotel in the rain, getting soaked, and I couldn't figure out why there was nobody around. There was nowhere. I didn't see anybody. I get to the hotel, and the guy says, boy, you're a brave soul. And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, it's radioactive rain out there. Nobody's going outside. I said, oh, now I get it. So anyhow, I lived there for a year. And the standards, the German standards for the amount of radiation that could be in milk, because cows, you know, radiation, the fallout lands on the grass, particularly radioactive iodine, which is a huge, huge byproduct of nuclear power generation, of fission, of uranium fission, is iodine. I forget the radio isotope number, but radioactive iodine. And radioactive iodine is extremely biologically active. Mammals, animals that have thyroid glands just suck up radioactive iodine because they think it's iodine, and iodine is something that we need. We all started out in the ocean at one point. I mean, you go back, you know, biologically, everything living on Earth started in the ocean where there's a lot of iodine, and we all need iodine. And so the radioactive iodine falls on the grass, the cows eat it, bang, it gets into their bloodstream, it goes right into their milk because, of course, their milk is supposed to provide the calf with the nutrients to grow, and calves need iodine because they have thyroid glands. And so you now have radioactive iodine in the milk. And so when I first moved to Germany, the standards were you couldn't have more than 5 becquerels per liter of milk. A becquerel is a measurement of emitted radiation. Couldn't have more than 5. In the first week after Chernobyl, they raised that 5 to 10. Then they raised the 10 to 100. Then they raised the 100 to 500. Within 3 months, it was 500 becquerels per liter of milk. And they had to do it because otherwise nobody could sell their milk. And, in fact, we had a Geiger counter. We bought it from the farm, you know, in Summertown, Tennessee. The folks, Steve Gaskin, they started this hippie commune back in the late 60s, the farm. And they made this little handheld Geiger counter, and $75. And we bought one right after Chernobyl, you know, when we were moving to Germany. And I would walk around in the supermarket with this thing, and you walk in, and it's going tick, 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 brrrr, tick, tick, tick. Tick, tick, tick. As you walk by the milk or as you walk by certain foods, you know, you walk by the mushrooms, that, you know, wild mushrooms, people collect them and they sell them in the supermarkets. Brrr. And every now and then, even walking around in the forest, I just got brrr, the meter would start going because a hot particle had fallen somewhere in that area. And Europe is still like this because, you know, the radiation doesn't go away in just a few years. I mean, we're talking about radioactive substances. A radioactive iodine's half-life, as I recall, is in the 20-year range, which only means it becomes half as radioactive in 20 years. And the radioactive isotope, the cesium was the other big one. There's two isotopes of cesium. One, as I recall, was around 18 years half-life, and the other was around 30-some-odd years, 38-year half-life. I'm sure somebody in the chat room will correct me with the exact details. But in any case, so they changed the standards. So here FDR is talking about this. He's talking about how these economic royalists have come along and they are reaching out to seize control of government. Why? Because they want to profit from it. They want to enhance their power and they want to enhance their wealth. But they can't just come out and say that they're doing that. They can't just say, yeah, this is what we're all about. So instead, they wrap themselves in the flag. and they spout the Constitution. Oh, we want on the Supreme Court strict constructionists who will not interpret the Constitution or who will only interpret it in the meaning of the founders. Well, excuse me, the founders didn't know anything about radioactivity or genetically modified products. And when this country was founded, abortion was perfectly legal. In fact, it was perfectly legal for the first 150, 200 years of this country's existence. Just to pick one of many, you know, pot was legal. George Washington grew it. In his diary, he talks about separating the male and the female plants. Female plants produce the buds that, you know, well, we need not get into that. Anyhow, a family show and all that. So, what they're really talking about, when the cons talk about they want somebody on the Supreme Court who's going to follow the Constitution and not interpret it, what they're really talking about is they want somebody who will use the language of the Constitution, who will wrap themselves in the flag for the purposes of promoting the interests of the economic royalists. As Franklin Roosevelt said,
in vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
As they are today.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
And now this is a really important point that he makes, and that is that the Constitution, and the flag for that matter, if you want, that the flag and the Constitution, that what they stand for is a protection of we the people from imperial power, from the power of mob rule. Here's two different powers. Number one, from imperial power, from kings and kingdoms. Of course, from churches, theocracies. From mob rule, from, you know, Adams referred to the rabble. James Madison wrote extensively about the danger of pure, unrestrained democracy, where if you could simply convince enough people of something, then, you know, you could get laws passed without representatives in the middle who might be a little more deliberative. And we certainly have seen this acted out in California, for example, where pure democracy, the referendum process, has in many cases had anti-democratic results, or at least results that aren't the best thing for the people. Proposition 13, for example, has resulted in just wild dislocations in real estate prices. You have one house, two houses next door to each other, and one is paying $1,000 a year in property taxes, the other is paying $100,000 a year in property taxes because one has been in the same hands for 30 years and the other has recently been sold. Does that make sense? Most people would say no, but it does. But in any case, the Constitution and the flag stand to protect us from both mob rule and the overprivileged alike, from the danger of excessive power from the bottom up or from the top down. And this is the point that Roosevelt made. And in fact, here's Franklin Roosevelt making this point.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny. For freedom, not subjection.
And keep in mind, what he was speaking of them was economic tyranny, economic subjection. And we're back here. We're back here again. And now, in the meantime, you find this story by Jacob Niss in the Independent of the UK. The Manhattan District Attorney, the Securities Exchange Commission, and the U.S. Internal Revenue Service are jointly probing a tax shelter plan run out of the Isle of Man. Now, the Isle of Man is, for all practical purposes, an independent country off the coast of England that has its own tax rules. The investigating bodies believe that up to 100 million dollars of tax was saved through just one scheme alone. As much as $700 million in taxes may have been avoided over an 11-year period. And who is it? Who is using this? Who is it who are benefiting from this? Well, the most prominent billionaires are Charles and Sam Wiley of Texas, who not only gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to George Bush's reelection campaigns, but also bankrolled TV advertisements attacking his rivals, John Kerry and Senator John McCain, the people behind the Swift Boat ads. Yes, folks. Does the tyranny of the overprivileged start to make sense? The Isle of Man authorities have passed documents to U.S. investigators relating to 20 different entities linked to the Wiley brothers that are registered in the Irish Sea tax haven, they add. The U.S. authorities declined to comment. Now, the administration, we got nothing to say about this. Sorry. Just because Bush's buddies saved $700 million in taxes with a phony tax shelter in the Isle of Man and gave a fair chunk of that money to George Bush to get reelected and ran ads attacking John Kerry's patriotism with it, we're not going to talk about it. Right? This is the news you won't hear on Right Wing Radio, I'll tell you that. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels.
Ah, yes. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I do, too. And now that we've heard from Franklin Roosevelt, the guy who brought us Social Security, the guy who brought us the New Deal, the fellow who rescued capitalism from itself, who rescued American democracy from the overreaching of the robber barons, here now, speaking on behalf of the robber barons of America, a multimillionaire, a man worth well over $100 million himself, commenting on Roosevelt and the fact that his centerpiece program, Social Security, should be done away with, should be turned into a private program or a welfare program, as George W. Bush is recommending. Here I bring you the bloviator himself.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Gives you a chill, doesn't it? The guy is just so smart. And so kind. And so understanding. Yeah. And we're in the... His policies live on, but we're...
His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Sean in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I got a question, a comment and a question.
Okay.
You'll never guess who else got an interview with George Galloway.
Who's that?
From the United States. Mr. Henny Penny, The Sky is Falling, Resistance is Futile, Buy My DVD, Alex Jones himself.
Oh, great.
Got an interview with George Galloway, and I haven't downloaded it yet, but I saw it was there and thought, oh, no.
Well, I'm not gonna speak to anybody else's, whatever.
Alex has got his good points, too.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the more often George Galloway's words get heard, the better it is for the United States.
Absolutely.
And let's just leave it at that.
It's just that Alex doesn't have any solutions except for buy my DVD. That's all he ever says what to do.
Yeah, well.
Anyway, and also, I was wondering, the medical marijuana person that you had on earlier today, he said that this Supreme Court ruling today was not as bad as it seems.
Yeah.
And why was that?
Well, because basically what the Supreme Court said was, we're not saying that pot should be illegal or should be legal. What we're saying is that Congress has to undo the laws that Congress has already passed back in the 1930s, making it a federal criminal offense. And in fact, there are several efforts now before Congress to do just that. So it may be a good thing. It may be the thing that was necessary to kick Congress in the butt, get them off dead center so that, you know, this thing gets done right.
They need to be kicked in the butt.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Sean. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And don't forget, you can call your member of Congress right now by dialing 1-877-SOB-USOB and asking for your member of Congress. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.